national mission to build citizen participation in the democratic process. We also study key community issues at all government levels in an unbiased manner. The agenda for today, I'm going to talk a little bit about the mechanics of voting, which have changed this year due to an initiative called Voters Choice. I will point out a few helpful online resources. I will talk briefly about candidates, and then I will jump to the main part of the talk, which is the statewide.
Excuse me, Pete.
Yes.
Just a second. It sounds like somebody is taking notes in the background, which is great, but can you please mute yourself? Thank you. Okay, sorry, Mike.
Good. I look forward to the day when we can do this in person again. It's been a challenge for everybody to convert to online. I'm learning new ways of being patient, and it's great. So the ground rules. I will give a description of each measure and the arguments for and against. I will do best to hide my opinion. I actually feel very strongly about a lot of these ballot propositions, but at the end of the presentation, if you cannot tell whether I'm for or against a measure, I will have done my job the right way. The idea is for me to give you enough information for you to decide what makes sense to you. So let's jump into voters' choice. Voters' choice is new this year in Santa Clara County. We have a little bit of experience for those of you who voted in the primary election way back in March. There are no longer neighborhood polling places. Instead, most people will vote by mail, or you can vote in person at any vote center in the county. And I will get into where the vote centers are and what you can do. If you do vote by mail, you can return your ballot in the envelope that comes with it for free. You do not need to put any stamps on it, and you can drop it in any mailbox. There are also official ballot drop boxes. These are large metal white things that appear a bit like mailboxes, but they say vote drop off on them. Those are located in front of most libraries and at other select locations throughout the county. Now, for vote centers, you can drop off your ballot there as well. Those are staffed, and they have language assistance. And the most important thing for this group is that they do have accessible voting equipment there. You are also able, under current state law, to register and vote on the same day. So if you have not yet registered, it's possible to go to a vote center, register, and vote immediately. Those will be open from 9 a.m. until 5 p.m., starting about 2 weeks before the election. It varies from vote center to vote center. And then on election day itself, they'll be open the same hours that the polls are usually open. At 7 o'clock in the morning until 8 o'clock at night. Now, I live in Mountain View, and in Mountain View, there are vote centers at a local Church of Scientology, St. Timothy's Church, which is near the El Camino Hospital. There are vote centers at the Cubberly Community Center, the Mountain View Community Center, Los Altos Youth Center. You can expect to find vote centers throughout the county at places like that. There is also remote accessible vote by mail this year. This is at-home voting for voters with disabilities and also works for overseas and military voters. Using remote accessible vote by mail, you can mark an electronic ballot using your own assistive technology at home. You then print your ballot or have someone else print it for you and return it by mail. The ballot selections that you make with this remote accessible technology, these ballot selections are not transmitted electronically through the internet. So it's very secure. Everything happens within your home. You mark your ballot, you print your ballot, you send it in. And the advantage, of course, is you can use the assistive technology that you are best at. The place to go to find more information and to get access to the remote assistive accessible vote by mail is the Santa Clara County Registrar of Voters, and their URL is sccvote.org. So that stands for Santa Clara County Vote.org. And make sure you do not go to sccvote.com. That domain is owned by, I believe, one of the local political parties, and you will get a lot of encouragement to vote for that party's candidates, but you won't get any information about how to vote with accessible technology. Sccvote.org will also have the locations of drop boxes and the locations of vote centers that have accessible technology. I'd like to point out a couple of additional online resources for you. One of my very favorites is called the Easy Voter Guide, and the URL for that is easyvoterguide.org. The Easy Voter Guide is available in at least 5 languages, English, Spanish, Chinese, Korean, and Vietnamese, and it has capsule summaries of the ballot propositions. It will tell you briefly the way it is now, what a proposition would do if it passes, what it would do, what would happen if it fails, and its effect on the state budget, as well as a couple of arguments for and against each one. So once again, that's easyvoterguide.org. And for those of you who are more political junkies like I am, you might be interested in the more detailed version of the Easy Voter Guide. It's called voteresedge.org. voteresedge.org. When you reach that website, it will ask you to enter your street address and zip code, and it will calculate exactly what contests are on your ballot where you live, including contests for city council and school board, and any local ballot measures. And of course, it has all of the candidates, including contests for president and House of Representatives and state legislature. You can compare candidates. They have sent out questionnaires to all of the candidates asking for their positions on salient issues. And perhaps my favorite feature is it allows you to follow the money. There are listings of the contributions and contributors to each candidate. So you can see, for instance, in my state Senate district, there are 2 candidates. One of them has raised over $1 million. The other one has raised merely $6,000 and appears to be self-funding his campaign. And you can see whether there are candidates who are backed by special interests and what those special interests are. And finally, let me put in a plug for my own League of Women Voters website. That's LWVLAMV, the League of Women Voters of the Los Altos Mountain View area. League has chapters that cover virtually all of the state. There are chapters in Palo Alto, Cupertino, and the largest in our county covers both Santa Clara and San Jose. So you can look those up online using your favorite search engine. So before I move on, are there any questions on these online resources or on the voting process this year? Okay, hearing none, I will move.
I do have a question.
Go ahead.
The websites that you just gave, are those just statewide or are they also nationwide?
Most of them are statewide. The Voter's Edge covers the presidential election as well.
Okay. I'm just asking because I moved out of state, so...
Oh, I see. Okay. Yes. What state are you in now?
Tennessee.
It's possible that Voter's Edge and Easy Voter Guide cover those. You would really have to log on and see.
And check. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, Voter's Edge started in a few states, California, Illinois, and a couple of others. I do not know whether it has got Tennessee yet.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Good. So when I give these talks in my home area, I will cover all of the local races. But since this is countywide, the only race I will talk about is the presidential race. There are going to be six parties with candidates for president, Democratic and Republican, of course, also Peace and Freedom, Green Party, Libertarian, and the American Independent Party, which is not the same as independent or no party registration. There's actually a party called American Independent, and they have a candidate for president and vice president. So you'll be able to vote for any of those six party slates, or you can write in your own choice. The legislative elections, things like House of Representatives, State Senate, State Assembly, there will be only two candidates for each contest. And because of what we call top two voting, only the top two finishers from the March primary will appear on your ballot. And you are not allowed to do write-in voting. So your choice is simply between those two candidates of whatever party they are. You might have two Democrats running against each other. That's the way it is in my congressional district. Or you might have an independent and a member of a party. And where I live... in Mountain View, we will have candidates, we will have contests in addition for all of these federal and state legislative. There will be a judge on my ballot to vote yes or no on. There's the County Board of Education, the Community College District, High School District, Elementary School District, and City Council, as well as the Hospital District. So it is a very long ballot. And I admire your organization for getting such a head start on all of it. And so let me get to the main event, the ballot propositions. There are 12 statewide ballot propositions on the ballot. The first one is numbered 14 and the last one is numbered 25. There is also one local measure that covers all of Santa Clara County. And that is for Caltrain. And I think showing a bit of a sense of humor, the registrars have decided to call this Measure RR, standing for railroad, I think. So Proposition 14 is the first of these. Proposition 14 is a bond measure. A bond means a loan that the state takes out. Proposition 14 authorizes a loan for $5.5 billion, which will be repaid from the state's general fund at a cost of roughly $260 million a year over the course of roughly 30 years. The general fund is where your state income taxes go, and it is also funded by a number of other means. The proceeds of this $5.5 billion from Proposition 14 will fund research using stem cells to discover new medical treatments. This is a follow-on to a bond that was passed by the public in 2004. And those bonds paid for the construction of stem cell research centers at UC San Francisco, at Stanford, at UCLA, and at other educational institutions across the state. It has also funded new research centers at private nonprofit institutions, and also at some biotech companies that are for profit. Within Proposition 14, about $1.5 billion will be dedicated to discovering cures for neurological and brain disorders such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. The arguments in favor of Proposition 14 are that it will help fight serious diseases, including cancer, diabetes, and neurological disorders, that the federal funding, which typically is what funds scientific and medical research, is unreliable for stem cell research because many stem cell lines come from unused embryos, and people who object to abortions and other have other religious objections to using embryonic stem cells, don't believe the federal government ought to fund this. So for that reason, the federal funding is has been on and off over the last 15 years. And the final argument in favor of Proposition 14 is that the construction work and the research work creates jobs, and the people who favor Prop 14 point to a figure of roughly 50 to 60,000 jobs that have been created. The arguments against Prop 14, as I pointed out before, are the objections to use of embryonic stem cells. Another argument against it is that it is inappropriate to use bonds, which are a long-term loan, to fund private laboratories and also to fund short-term expenses. And here I want to point out that the money from Prop 14 will fund not just new buildings, which have a long life, but also administration and such things as laboratory supplies and equipment and possibly even laboratory chemicals. And the final argument against Proposition 14 is that in this current time of uncertainty regarding the state budget, we are not in a position to take on an additional obligation or commitment of $250 million a year for the next 30 years. So that's Proposition 14. I'll move on now to Proposition 15. Proposition 15 has to do with property taxes. Excuse me. Currently in California, when property is purchased, it is assessed at the price, typically at the purchase price, and you pay property taxes based on that. And then for the subsequent years that you continue to own the property, the assessment can increase up to 2% a year, even if the actual resale or potential resale value would increase far more than that, with the effect that if you or a company owns a piece of property over a long term, there is, in essence, a deep discount on the property tax. Proposition 15 would end this deep discount for commercial and industrial property, creating what some people call a split roll, where commercial and industrial property would be taxed based on its current value, not the purchase price, while residential real estate, a home that you own, would be unaffected and would continue to be taxed based on the purchase price plus the 2% per year increase. Under Prop 15, there will be exceptions for small business, and small business is defined as a business that owns less than $3 million worth of real estate. And Prop 15 would exclude the first $500,000 worth of business equipment from being taxed. Many of you might not be aware, if you own a business, not only is the real estate considered property that's taxed, but also any significant business equipment that you own, that's considered business property and is also taxed. Under Prop 15, if you own less than $500,000 worth of business equipment, you will not be taxed on that at all. The effect of Proposition 15 is it will provide somewhere between $7 and $11 billion of additional property tax revenue to the state and the local governments. 40% of that is dedicated to schools and community colleges. Arguments in favor of Proposition 15. The first argument is that Proposition 13, way back in 1978, which instituted the current, what I call deep discount, or maximum 2% property tax increase, that proposition was never intended to benefit corporations. It was intended instead to allow people to stay in their homes without having to deal with rapidly inflating property tax bills. The second argument in favor of 15 is that this money is needed for schools, fire departments, and other local services. And the third argument in favor of 15 is that small businesses will be protected with the $3 million and $500,000 of equipment exclusions. Arguments against Proposition 15 are that, first and foremost, it is a tax increase, and raising taxes on business will increase the cost of everything. The second argument against 15 is that despite the exclusions of 3 million and half a million, many small businesses will be hurt because 3 million and half a million isn't very much when it comes to business and real estate. And the final argument against Proposition 15 is that school districts in wealthier districts, in school districts in wealthier areas, which are funded on a different formula, and this formula is referred to as basic aid for those of you who are budget nerds, that these school districts will not actually get any of the new revenue because of how they are funded by the state. The argument here, and I won't go into great detail on it, has to do with the funding formula for these wealthier districts, many of which are located in Santa Clara County. They currently get all of their funding from local property tax revenue. When the taxes on business and commercial property go up, if Proposition 15 passes, that money will not go to the local districts. Instead, it will go to the state for distribution to school districts and community college districts throughout the state. And the formula that's in Proposition 15 for doing that may exclude basic aid districts. This is unclear, and there are a lot of conflicting opinions on exactly what the language in the proposition means. So I'm going to leave it there. But that's the end of Proposition 15. I will do one more, and then we'll stop for questions. Proposition 16 has to do with affirmative action in California. Affirmative action allows public agencies and universities to include race, sex, color, ethnicity, and country of origin as part of their decision-making. In the case of an agency, the decision-making would be on hiring or on hiring a contractor in order to do some public work. In the case of colleges and universities, this would primarily be related to admissions to the college or the university. Proposition 16 would enable affirmative action in California. Up until now, affirmative action has been illegal in California due to a ballot measure that was passed back in 1996. So in essence, Prop 16 would repeal that ban that was passed 24 years ago. Proposition 15, rather 16, once again, would re-enable affirmative action in California. Arguments in favor: it enables a necessary remedy for centuries of discrimination against women and people of color. Second argument in favor of 16 is that this is a concrete step that voters can take to support social justice. And a third argument is that studies have shown that affirmative action in California will not disadvantage Asian Americans in college admissions, as many have claimed. Arguments against Proposition 16. The state should be race blind and treat everyone equally. Another argument is that not every minority member is disadvantaged. It would make more sense to help only those who need it. And finally, preferential treatment leads to higher contract costs than the current method of awarding contracts to the lowest qualified bidder. So I'll pause here. Any questions on 14, 15, or 16? And to remind you, 14 was stem cell bonds, 15 is the split property tax roll, and 16 is affirmative action.
This is John Glass. I'd like to ask a quick question on Proposition 15, if I could.
Sure, go ahead.
So my question is, if Proposition 15 doesn't pass, how would that affect property tax for people who own their own homes? Would it continue to be increasing at approximately the 2% per year, or would there be the possibility that that rate could be increased?
Ah, good question. There will be no impact on residential property taxes, regardless of whether 15 passes or fails.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. I will move forward.
This is Noel.
Oh, yes. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I couldn't get in before to ask a question. When you said that our vote remotely would all be done at home and that at the end of the process, the ballot would be sent in, could you clarify what you meant by sent in, whether that's mail only or whether that's returned via the internet?
Sure. Actually, I'm going to back up to my notes on that so that I get it right. So if you're referring to the remote accessible vote by mail, you fill out your ballot at home, print it, and then mail it in. It in essence allows you to vote at home the same way you would with the paper ballot that they send to you, but you get to do it using your own assistive technology. Is that clear?
Thank you. I just wanted to have it clarified for people that might have been confused, thinking that it was all done at home, where you still have to mail the envelope, though.
That's right. Yes. Your ballot selections are not going to be transmitted electronically or automatically. If you use the vote at home with remote accessible, you still have to send in your ballot.
Or you could take it to a vote center.
That's correct, yes. Or you can take it to a vote center. And don't forget, at the vote centers, they will have assistive technology, so you can vote at the vote center as well.
Thank you.
Good. Well, I will continue on then with the next set of propositions. Proposition 17 has to do with voting by people who have been convicted of felonies and spent time in state prison. At the end of their prison terms, they are released typically in a condition known as parole. Parole is a transitional period where the people who have been released from prison adjust to life back in society, and there are parole officers who assist them. Currently, people who are on parole are not allowed to register or vote. Under Proposition 17, those released from prison will be allowed to vote while on parole after completing their term in prison. People who are still in prison will be ineligible to vote. They will remain ineligible to vote under 17. So all Prop 17 does is allows those who are on parole to vote. This would affect roughly 50,000 Californians. Arguments in favor of Proposition 17. Parole is to retrain felons to be good citizens, and voting is a key part of citizenship, so we should allow them to vote. Studies have shown that recidivism, which is additional crimes, is lower in places that allow parolees to vote, and that other states, such as Utah, Indiana, and North Dakota, allow parolees to vote. Arguments against Proposition 17. Felons should complete a whole sentence, including parole, before voting. Voting should be reserved until after parolees have proved that they've changed. And finally, crime victims deserve justice, and allowing parolees to vote is not justice. That's Proposition 17. Proposition 18 has to do with 17-year-olds. Under Proposition 18, if you are 17 years old, but you will turn 18 years old by the time the general election occurs, then you will be allowed to vote in that year's primary election. This year, our primary election was held in March. If you were 17 in March, but will turn 18 by November 3rd, then under this ballot proposition, you would have been able to vote way back in March. The arguments in favor of Prop 18 are anyone who can vote in a general election should vote in the nominating contest for that election, and allowing 17-year-olds to vote in primary elections will increase voter interest and participation. Arguments against Prop 18. 17-year-olds are not legally adults and will not take elections seriously. And high school teachers and counselors will be able to influence how their students vote. So that's Prop 18. And I've got to say, Prop 18 is perhaps not the most significant proposition on the ballot. Proposition 19, once again, has to do with property taxes and that 2% deep discount, sometimes referred to as a reassessment exemption. Under Proposition 19, certain homeowners will be allowed to transfer their property tax base to a replacement residence of any value, any place in the state, up to 3 times. So let me back up here and talk about current laws relating to moving from home to home. Under current law, if you are over age 55 or severely disabled or the victim of a fire or contamination or some other disaster, if you move to a home of equal or lesser value within your current county, you are allowed to keep your current property taxes. And this can be a very significant savings. If you happen to have lived, if you happen to have owned your home for, let's say, 20 years, your home in Santa Clara County is likely to have doubled or tripled in its actual value, yet your property taxes will have only gone up modestly. If you decide to downsize or move to a less expensive home someplace else in Santa Clara County, without this protection, you would get a complete new reassessment and your property taxes would double or triple, which can be a hardship for people on fixed incomes. So the current law limits you to a house of equal or lesser value, and it has to be in the same county or in one of 10 counties that have special reciprocal arrangements. Under Proposition 19, these exemptions would be expanded to include houses that are more valuable than your current house. You'd be able to upsize as well as downsize. And you could do it anywhere in the state. You would not be limited to your current county. Under current law, you can get this transfer once in your lifetime. Under Proposition 19, it would be expanded to three times in your lifetime. So this is going to, over the long run, reduce the amount of property taxes that the government will collect. Proposition 19 has a provision that will offset that, and that has to do with inherited property. Currently, when you inherit property from your parents, it is not reassessed. Under Proposition 19, it would be above the $1 million mark. So if it's a small piece of property, you continue that assessment exemption. But if there is a large home or a particularly valuable home, there will be a reassessment at market value. And under Proposition 19, also the reassessment exemption would no longer apply to businesses or inherited second homes. And in this way, the authors of Proposition 19 are attempting to create a ballot proposition that's revenue neutral, and it will transfer, in essence, the tax burden from homeowners who upsize to people who have inherited their homes. Arguments in favor of Proposition 19. Fire victims should not be penalized further by paying higher property taxes on replacement homes. Empty nesters will downsize, allowing younger families to move in if Prop 19 passes. And Prop 19 closes a loophole for inheritors of mansions and other large estates. Arguments against Proposition 19. It takes away two protections that families have and may force some to sell their family's property. So this is referring to inheritors. If you have property that has been in the family, it will be largely reassessed when the inheritance takes place. Arguments against 19 include that this amounts to a $1 billion tax increase. That refers to an estimate that over the long run, Prop 19 will increase the total property tax collected in the state. And finally, Prop 19 is nothing more than an attempt by the real estate industry to increase property sales at the expense of property inheritance, which doesn't benefit the real estate industry. And Proposition 20. Proposition 20 has to do with parole and property crimes. Under Proposition 20, it will be harder for felons to qualify for parole after serving the term for their primary offenses. Prop 20 will reclassify for parole purposes crimes such as robbery, extortion, and elder abuse. Those will now be classified as violent crimes, which has an impact on whether and when convicts are eligible for parole. Proposition 20 will allow people who are have been arrested for a third, fourth, or fifth shoplifting or petty theft offense It will allow those people to be prosecuted under a felony rather than a third, fourth, or fifth misdemeanor. And finally, Proposition 20 will require police departments and sheriffs to collect DNA evidence from certain misdemeanor convicts. Arguments in favor of Prop 20. It will prevent violent criminals from getting out of prison early. It will treat habitual petty criminals as felons. And the DNA from convicted drug possessors and shoplifters will help police and sheriff departments solve more serious crimes. Arguments against 20. It will keep more people in prison longer at a time when we should be reducing prison populations. It will overturn voter decisions from recent elections. And this refers to a pair of ballot propositions that tended to reduce sentences and requirements for parole that passed over the last decade. And the final argument against Prop 20 is that it will waste millions of dollars on prisons that could be spent by the government on healthcare, education, and housing. So I'll stop here and ask if there are any questions on 17 through 20. Those were parolee voting, voting by 17-year-olds, property tax exemption for older and disabled homebuyers, and parole and property crimes.
This is Lorraine Brown.
Yes.
On Proposition 19, on the inherited part, that $1 million, is it, are you talking about over the million or just because the property is worth more than a million, it would be the whole thing?
Right. This can be confusing. When you inherit property, there is a $1 million exemption. So the first $1 million of value will not be reassessed, but any value above that would be reassessed.
Okay, gotcha. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, I had to get out my calculator and go to the chalkboard and figure out exactly what this meant. It's not easy. And I want to say here that, and this is my personal opinion, I'm not sure how fair it is to ask 20 million voters to become one day legislators. And take in such a dazzling kaleidoscope of issues, from criminal justice to property taxation to stem cell bonds. So I admire everyone on this call for caring and for paying attention and wanting to do the right thing. I suppose that can also be League's opinion. All right, moving on. Proposition 21. Proposition 21 has to do with rent control. There are roughly 15 cities in California that have local rent control ordinances. And those include 9 in the Bay Area and the rest are in Southern California, clustered around Los Angeles. And those rent control, local rent control ordinances cannot apply to any building built after 1995. So rent control currently in those cities applies only to buildings that are more than 25 years old. There are a couple of other limitations on what rent control can do. Rent control cannot apply to single-family homes in those cities, and it cannot apply to condominiums. Now, there's some late-breaking news on rent control. Earlier this year, the state passed its own rent control. It's a temporary measure. It lasts only 10 years. And it applies to all parts of the state that don't have local rent control. So if you live, say, in Mountain View or San Francisco or San Jose, where they do have local rent control ordinances, your current rent control ordinance applies. If you live in, let's say, Fremont or Milpitas, which do not have local rent control, then you're covered by the state. And the state rent control applies not to buildings that are 25 years or older. It applies to buildings that are 15 years or older. And that 15 years will roll forward. So this year, if your building was built in 2005 or later, there's no rent control. Next year, buildings built in 2005 will be covered, but those built 2006 or later will be exempt. Proposition 21 would take some of those elements of the state law and apply them to local laws, or I should say it would allow local city councils to apply them to the local laws. It would be up to the city councils whether to enact any of Proposition 21. Prop 21 doesn't force any city to do anything to its local rent control, but it allows them more latitude. It allows them to apply rent controls to housing as young as 15 years instead of the current 25 years. It permits local governments like cities to apply rent control to single family homes and condominiums. And it also, for the first time, permits rent control on vacant units or increases between tenants. This is referred to as vacancy control. Under Prop 21, a local ordinance would be allowed to prohibit any rent increases above and beyond what is ordinarily allowed from year to year. With one exception, they have to allow the landlord to temporarily bump the rent by 15% for a temporary period of 3 years. And this is to fund renovations to an apartment unit, such as putting in new carpet between tenants. Proposition 21 applies only to landlords who own more than two units. So if you are renting out a room in your house, or if you have, let's say, two homes, and you're renting one of them out, you would be exempt from local rent controls. And also under state law, and this has been confirmed by the courts, all rent control, whether it's state or local, must allow what's referred to as a fair rate of return for the landlords. So if the rent doesn't cover the landlord's mortgage, for instance, that's considered unfair, and the landlord must be able to raise the rent to cover mortgage and expenses at the very least, plus a reasonable profit. And what reasonable is up to the courts and the local rent control boards. So that is your lesson on rent control for today. There will not be a quiz, but let me tell you arguments in favor and against Prop 21. In favor, rent control helps families, seniors, and veterans stay in their homes. Rent control guarantees that landlords can make a profit. Moving the 25-year limit to 15 is still long enough to reward developers for building much needed housing. Arguments against 21. Rent control discourages developers from building more desperately needed housing. Rent control laws delay apartment repairs. And rent control, particularly of the type in Prop 21, can reduce some home values by as much as 20%. And I do not have a source for that 20%, but there's a study that's cited there. So that's Proposition 21. Proposition 22 has to do with gig economy drivers. These are drivers for transportation services like Uber and Lyft, and also drivers for delivery services such as DoorDash. Under current law, and the current law is fairly new, it went into effect at the beginning of 2020. Under current law, these gig economy drivers are employees, not independent contractors. As employees, they are entitled to receive minimum wage with higher pay for overtime. They are required to receive sick time, unemployment insurance, health insurance, and workers' compensation. And let me right here make the distinction between the difference between an independent contractor and an employee and a part-time and full-time worker. It is possible to be a part-time employee. In fact, this is how many of the people in the food service industry are classified. They are employees, but they do not work 40-hour weeks. And the same is true today of these gig economy drivers. They are classified as employees. Now, companies like Uber and Lyft and DoorDash have been fighting against this in court, and they have the cases are making their way slowly through the court. The initial court case was ruled against the companies, but it has been appealed, and so it's kind of up in the air. Under Proposition 22, the law would be changed to classify these drivers as independent contractors, not as employees. So under Proposition 22, these drivers would no longer be eligible for minimum wage, overtime, unemployment, workers' compensation, and so forth. Instead, under Proposition 22, the workers would be guaranteed certain benefits. They would be guaranteed 120% of minimum wage during the hours that they are actually driving passengers or delivering. And studies have shown that these drivers tend to spend on average about one third of their time waiting for the next ride order. So if you multiply the two thirds time that they would be actively engaged by the 120% of minimum wage, that comes out to 80% of minimum wage for the entire time that they're on call. On the other hand, during the time that they're on call and not actively driving, that time is their own. Under Proposition 22, there would also be a health stipend that would be paid from the companies to these independent contractors, depending on how many hours per week they are driving. If they average 25 hours a week, they would get 82% of the premiums for the lowest bronze level plan that is available from Covered California, the Affordable Care Act branch in California. And they would get half of that if they worked between 15 and 25 hours. And once again, these are not hours that they're on call. These are hours that they're actively driving passengers or delivering. Proposition 22 also guarantees a 12-hour workday maximum. Finally, Prop 22 will prohibit local regulation of these services. So it would be at the state level only.
Today's
arguments in favor of Proposition 22. Number one is that drivers want flexible schedules. Many of them work part-time, have other full-time jobs, or have commitments as parents, and want to be able to work whatever hours they happen to be available. The next argument in favor of 22 is that the business model of rideshare and delivery companies requires the use of independent contractors rather than full-time or part-time employees. And finally, if Prop 22 were to fail, hundreds of thousands of good jobs would be lost. Arguments against Prop 22. You can have a flexible schedule and be a part-time employee at the same time. Another argument is that these companies make billions of dollars and can afford to pay employee benefits to the drivers. And finally, drivers deserve sick leave, unemployment, overtime, and other benefits the way other part-time employees and full-time employees have. That's Prop 22. And I should mention that Prop 22 is the people sponsoring it, the people, the corporations sponsoring it, have, I believe, surpassed the largest campaign budget in history. So there will be a media, there already is a large media presence in favor of Prop 22. If you hear about any ballot propositions, this is likely to be the one that you'll hear about. Next, Proposition 23. This has to do with the regulation of kidney dialysis clinics. There are two main companies, they're called DaVita and Fresenius, that provide dialysis clinics to serve people who have kidney failure. And they have clinics throughout the state. They each have hundreds of clinics. Prop 23 would add certain regulations to these clinics. The first regulation, it would require them to have a doctor present whenever patients are receiving treatment. Second, the clinics would need permission from the State Department of Health before reducing services at any clinic or closing a clinic. And third, clinics could not discriminate against clients based on their insurance. And this refers to the fact that when these clinics bill a private insurance company, they are reimbursed at roughly four times the rate that they're reimbursed when Medicare or Medi-Cal patient comes through. And there has been a case recently where these clinics have steered certain Medicare and Medi-Cal patients away from Medicare and Medi-Cal. They cancel that insurance and sign up instead with a private insurer with their premiums subsidized by a charity. And then the clinic is much more eager to have them as a patient, and the clinic gets reimbursed at the much higher rate. Under Prop 23, the clinics would not be allowed to discriminate against people who are on public health care.
Trouble. A-R-O-U-B-N.
Arguments in favor of Prop 23. Dialysis is a dangerous procedure, and it requires the presence of a doctor. Rural communities need protections from closures, and so the requirement to have the state approve closures of clinics is a good thing. And clinics should not push Medicare patients onto private insurance to collect higher reimbursements. Arguments against 23. Doctors are unnecessary at these clinics. It's routine care, and the doctors are needed elsewhere. The increased cost of this measure would force some clinics to close, making it harder for patients, particularly in remote and rural areas, to get life-saving treatment. And voters already rejected a similar measure 2 years ago in 2018. So let me pause here. Are there any questions on 23, 22? Or I believe, have I asked on 21? Anyway, any questions on anything I've asked, I've discussed so far?
I have a question. I'm a little confused because I thought when you were talking about 22, you said a yes vote would give these drivers employee benefits. But it looked like the no argument was saying that that's what would happen if you voted no.
Good. I'm glad you asked that. Under current law, they are classified as employees and they are entitled to the benefits. If 22 passes, they will no longer be eligible for those benefits.
No longer after it passes. Thank you very much.
Yes. Prop 22 would reclassify these drivers as independent contractors, and they would no longer be eligible for these benefits. Good. On to Proposition 24. 24 has to do with consumer privacy rules. Under Prop 24, consumers will have increased power over their personal data that is that they have given to primarily online companies, but any other company as well. 24 will prevent these companies from sharing sensitive personal information, such as location, health care history, and your communications. Prop 24 will require these companies to correct your personal data when you request them to do that. Prop 24 creates a new state agency to oversee privacy laws, and it implements new fines for data breaches. Under current law, if a violation of data privacy happens, the companies typically will not have to pay the fine if they correct the condition and can show that they've corrected the condition within 30 days. Under Prop 24, they won't be able to do that any longer. If there's a violation, they will have to pay the fine. And under Prop 24, the fines will be higher. I believe they will be tripled if they involve the data of children. Now, I should point out that earlier this year, a new data privacy law went into effect. Prop 24 will change a lot of the existing law. It's a very long ballot proposition. It's over 30 pages of fine print in one of the ballot pamphlets. Prop 24 will make certain elements of that new state law stronger. It will make other parts not as strong. It's very complex. And there's no way I could get into many of the details in this forum. So the arguments in favor of Prop 24 are: we need to prevent companies from tracking everything we do online. Prop 24 protects children by giving the state more power to go after violators. And Prop 24 establishes an enforcement arm, this new state agency, to defend our rights. Arguments against 24. A new data privacy law just went into effect, and we should wait and see whether that works before we enact a new one. Prop 24 still gives too much power to technology companies, and consumers shouldn't have to demand data protection from these companies. It should be automatic. That's Prop 24. And I'm afraid I have to apologize for not being able to be very clear about it. It's very complex and nuanced. The last statewide proposition is Prop 25. Prop 25 would eliminate cash bail in California. Currently, when you are arrested, you are taken to the county jail and booked ordinarily, and then you have to post bail, which is essentially to give collateral to the courts as a promise that you will appear in court when ordered before they let you out. Those who cannot afford to pay bail under the current system are kept in jail. And there is an industry known as the bail bond industry that provides loans to people for bail in the form of a bail bond. And so the people who use bail bonds pay less than the full amount of bail that the court has ordered, but it is typically a percentage of 5 to 10% of the amount of bail, and there is a non-refundable fee, so it still costs something. So under Proposition 25, bail payment will be completely eliminated. Instead, all arrestees would be released free unless a court determines that they are at risk of either committing a new crime or missing a court date. Part of the evaluation of the risk for committing a crime or missing a court date is a computer program that uses machine learning, artificial intelligence, if you like, based on the demographic and personal data of the person who has been arrested. That gives advice that classifies the person as high risk, medium risk, or low risk. It does not the sole determinant. If you've been arrested, that will be one element of the risk assessment. Finally, under Prop 25, if you are determined to be moderate risk, you could be released for free, and a tracking device or check in with a probation officer may be required during your release while awaiting trial. Arguments in favor of Prop 25. Bail is inherently unfair. The rich can be released from jail while the poor must stay in jail. Justice should not be based on a person's net worth. Another argument again in favor of 25 are that decisions should be based on public safety, not money. And bail forces some guilty pleas to crimes people didn't commit. In essence, if you are unable to afford bail, you might be able to make a deal where you plead guilty to a lesser crime and are released with, let's say, a suspended sentence, but at least you get out and you don't suffer from having been incarcerated. Arguments against Prop 25. Zero bail lets dangerous criminals onto the street. It means more work for already overburdened courts. And the AI algorithm, the artificial intelligence algorithm, is biased against minority since it has been trained on data from an already discriminatory system. So it will simply perpetuate that. And the last ballot measure I want to talk about is Measure RR, which is not a statewide proposition, but a local proposition that applies to all of Santa Clara, San Mateo, and San Francisco counties. Proposition RR would enact a sales tax increase of 1/8%, 1/8 of a cent on every dollar. This would be enforced for 30 years. The impact would be to provide $100 million per year for Caltrain. Caltrain is currently funded by contributions from the three counties, from Valley Transit, VTA, from SamTrans in San Mateo, and from the city of San Francisco, and also by fares from riders, of course. That would be largely replaced by this $100 million per year from the sales tax. And Caltrain has many capital improvements that it wants to spend money on, in particular electrification, which involves replacing all of its diesel locomotives with electric cars. This would enable them to run smaller trains much more frequently, and it would also reduce air pollution from those large diesel locomotives. In order for Prop RR to go into effect, it must be passed by 2/3 vote in all three counties. Arguments in favor of RR, or double R, and I should point out, those of you who are into pop culture, today has been designated official Talk Like a Pirate Day. I don't know how many of you are aware of that. But it shows up. My kids are big into this. So instead of calling it Measure RR, today I have been told I have to call it Measure R, you scurvy dogs. So in favor of RR, it will save Caltrain from shutdown and preserve Caltrain service for thousands of essential workers, such as nurses, teachers, and first responders. Measure R will fund system improvements, such as electrification, and it will provide faster and more frequent trains that reduce noise and air pollution. And finally, Measure RR will prevent traffic congestion by removing cars from our highways. Against Measure RR, Caltrain ridership may not recover following the loss during COVID-19. Riders can continue to work remotely and they won't need the train. Also against Measure RR, low and middle income earners and the unemployed cannot afford a higher sales tax. And finally, the existing transportation taxes can fund Caltrain at its current service level. So any questions about any of the ballot propositions that I have discussed?
Yes, this is Lorraine. On Prop 25, is California the first state to do this, or is there some background data available?
Ooh, good question. I knew this a couple of weeks ago, and I have forgotten. I would have to do the research myself. I believe cash bail has been eliminated in some states, but don't quote me on that. I guess I'm afraid my answer is I don't know.
Okay, thank you. You're not expected to know everything.
Well, and this is also what you get for being first. I don't know exactly what I need to know. Any other questions? All right, good. Well, I want to congratulate you all on your perseverance in sitting through all of this. It's like sitting through 13 lectures on completely different subjects, and I'm glad that you are interested enough to pay attention through the whole thing. So you've got my admiration.
We really want to thank you for a wonderful presentation, and just very, very well done, and as usual. And we just thanks for taking your time and energy and allowing us to be the first of the year for you, and keep up the good work.
Good, thank you.
Yay.
Good luck.
This is Michelle.
Go ahead, Michelle.
I just wanted to add in a comment for regarding Prop 22, the gig economy. There was, just to remind people, that there was a proposition, or there was a bill passed, AB5, earlier this year, in the last year, I forget when, but it, before that bill was passed, drivers such as Uber and Lyft drivers and et cetera were able to be independent contractors. And it affected a lot of other industries and companies as well. But this bill, this proposition, seeks to reverse the AB5 for some groups, not all groups, though.
Yeah, I would say yes, that's accurate. AB5 grew out of an earlier court decision. There was a court decision in 2018 that most freelancers and independent contractors should in fact receive employee benefits. AB5 in essence, codified that into law. It went into effect at the beginning of 2020. Just 2 weeks ago, Governor Newsom signed a revision of AB 5 that exempted freelance musicians and other performing artists, and also photographers and reporters and other journalists. But it did not exempt these gig economy drivers. And so it is just the gig economy drivers who are at issue in Prop 22.
Okay, any other questions for Pete?
I'd just like to say that it seems appropriate that musicians should be excluded since they invented the word gig. You know, all my friends...
Any questions for Pete?
Oh, don't be that way. Come if I want to.
No, you're welcome, but we're taking his time here, so... just want to have serious questions.
Your gig is over, Roger.
Pete, it's Susan. I just want to thank you for this wonderful, articulate presentation. And you're so. I look forward to this whenever you come. And you're right. This is some citizenship work that's going to require deep thought. And you set us on an excellent road for that. And so, thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome, and it was my pleasure, and I wish you all well.
Thank you.